You're listening to Simple Flight Aviation Radio with Al Waterloo and Mark Eppner on www.simpleflight.net.
Simple Flight Radio, ready for takeoff.
What do you think about flying? Is it a sport? A business? Is it easy or difficult? Is it boring or exciting? Alan Waterloo and Mark Eppner think it may be any of those things, but they like to make it simple. This is Simple Flight Radio, where Mark and Al talk about the many aspects of aviation and the amazing people doing amazing things to make this world a better place.
Listen! Look! Here comes Sky King! Sky King, America's favorite flying cowboy. Presented by America's favorite peanut butter, Peter Pan Peanut Butter.
Peter Pan Peanut Butter? Hey, good evening, everybody. It's Mark Eppner with Simple Flight Radio. It must be 8 o'clock, actually 8:02 in the Central Time Zone. And that can only mean one thing, and that is Simple Flight Aviation Radio. I sent out a tweet, and I put the question out there, will Al Waterloo be here tonight? I'm looking around. I don't see him. I'm checking my Skype. I don't hear him. So guess what? I'm going solo. Happy to be here with you. Missing Al, but I think this is perfect for kind of the business climate with aviation. Al is so busy running his business. He has a wonderful organization, obviously called Simple Flight. And he's traveling the country. He's in great demand, and so he can't be with us. I think he's in Lubbock, Texas. Al, if you're out there, give me a little tweet. And matter of fact, for any of you, we've got a lot of things to talk about tonight, and I'm going to need your help. This is Crew Cockpit Resource Management, where we need to have other people besides me. Otherwise, I'm going to be task-saturated tonight. Happy to, again, have you here. I was out flying yesterday and today in Chicago. It is beautiful. We'll call it a warm time. I guess that's relatively speaking. It was probably 40 today and mid-40s yesterday, which in January is pretty good for Chicago. But it was really interesting flying yesterday. The winds at the ground were, you know, gusting mid-20s. And at 2,000 feet, 2,500 feet, they were 50 knots. And so we grabbed one of my friends here in the club. We got in the Piper Archer and flew from Papa Whiskey Kilo down to Clow International Airport, 1 Charlie 5, I think it is. There's a 1 Charlie. I don't even remember. I think that's it. But went down there and had the help of actually the hindrance of a 50-knot headwind. We had the help coming back. But what was interesting about it was the crazy crosswinds at the ground level. And it made me think, as I talked to a lot of people, what are your limits? And so maybe we can talk about that a little bit later in the show. So I want you to start thinking about that. At what level of winds do you ground yourself? And beyond that, if you've decided to go fly, we have an interesting situation here at Palwaukee, or Chicago Executive Airport. Three runways. Main one, 100 foot wide, is 1.6 and 3.4. 12 and 30 is 75 foot wide, pretty straight, a decently long runway, I think probably about 4,000 feet. And then a crazy runway, 2.4.6, which is has a significantly displaced threshold because of trees on the final approach to 2.4. It's not exactly a straight runway, and it has a hump in the middle. And it's caused one flight school to have none of the, let me put it this way, none of their students are allowed to use runway 2-4 because of bounces and prop strikes and things like that. And so in this case, yesterday we had, I think it was winds 220 at, 17 gust 29. And so, you know, between 1.6 and 2.4, obviously you'd rather have the 20 rather than the 60-degree offset, but yet most pilots are taking 1.6 just because of the quality of the runway. So that's something I'm going to want to talk to you about in a little bit. So let's kind of keep that on the back burner. Other thing was lots in the news, and so we're going to cover some of my, not pet peeves, but peeves I have. A couple of them involve the FAA, some decisions they've made recently, and I want to get your feedback on that. We've got some things in the news in business aviation. Matter of fact, we're going to have our friend Janine Iannarelli of Paravian on here in just a little bit, who's going to talk to us about the business aviation climate. And let's talk a little bit about the general aviation climate, not only from sales and all of that, but also with regards to safety. We've got some good news that was in the news this week. And then I want to visit. We're not going to be able to visit with our friends at Bold Method. Hope you guys are listening. But they had a quiz, and so we're going to talk a little quiz and make sure we're keeping our proficiency up. So with that, I want to remind everyone, hashtag Simple Flight, or tweet us at SimpleFlightNet. If I've got my Hootsuite up here, I'm able to run it. See, this is where I miss Al. He usually is doing the social media. He's got all the controls. I'm sitting here with a cup of water, an iPad, an iPhone, a desktop PC, and lights up everywhere, and I'd rather just put it on autopilot, because that's what Al is. I'm going to start calling him George, as a matter of fact. But so, again, we'll appreciate your investment of time in here and keeping me going and keeping me on the straight and narrow, because I need you. This is not a solo-type flight. This is one complex cockpit that I'm sitting in here. My apologies and my condolences to the Green Bay Packer fans out there. That was a tough way to lose a football game today, wasn't it? Oh, my goodness. You're up 16-0. Everything looks like it's going your way. All the calls, opponent steps out of bound by an inch. You just think it's going your way. Next thing you know, it goes to overtime thanks to a Green Bay field goal with 14 seconds left. And then lose it in overtime. So congratulations to Seattle, Green Bay, great team, just not their game today. And I don't even know what's going on. You'll have to tweet me what's going on in the Indiana New England game. Last I heard, New England was winning, but that was early in the game, so I'll look forward to getting my updates through you, because the TV's even off. I'm here in this little room all alone. I also want to hear from you as to what your flying's been like in the winter and any challenges that you have and things like that. So it will be a great show. Looking forward to having you join us. And if any of our other co-hosts, like Laura, I know she's busy doing inventory. Alex is at a winter home, even though he kind of comes and goes. So everyone seems out of town. So, again, we'll depend on our loyal listeners for where we're going with this tonight. You know, one of the things that I mentioned was that it was a very safe year in general aviation. And so I was reading an article today, and it was, you know, something that we're not used to reading. As a matter of fact, I understand there was an accident at Sebring at the Light Sport show that's down in Sebring. But let me pull up the article I had here. Where is that? Here we go. And so in 2013, which is the last year that they tracked for aviation safety. Here we go. It says in 2013 was the safest year on record for GA, and the first time ever the fatal accident rate dropped below one accident per 100,000 flight hours. Education, training, and technology all played a role in that success, and AOPA believes making it easier to bring modern safety equipment to the cockpits of existing type certificated aircraft will make GA even safer. As we look here at some of the numbers, and I apologize, I had that all. This is where you need it highlighted. I think there was the general aviation pilots flew in the United States nearly 23 million hours, and the total number of accidents involving helicopters and light airplanes declined 32% compared to a decade earlier. And the number of fatal accidents declined by 40% during the same 10-year period, and the fatal accident rate dropped to an all-time low of 0.9 fatal accidents per 100,000 flight hours. So, so many times when we're talking about that, it's, well, people are flying less because of the costs associated with flying, the lack of interest, the declining pilot population. But this is based on standards like per 100,000 flight hours. So that's very encouraging. Now, what's causing that? You know, I think technology has a lot to do with it, but we all know technology can drive up accidents because of distractions in the cockpit. And I don't know if it's that people are now getting more proficient in using that technology, or pilots are just bringing their A game to it. And I hope it's both of those things. I know when I fly with people, they don't seem as preoccupied with their head in the cockpit. I mean, there's a little bit of that, but generally I feel like they're doing our mantra of aviate, navigate, communicate. What do you think? Tweet me, hashtag Simple Flight, and I'd love to get your opinion on what's going on there. But it certainly is good news. You know, we have, I won't say a bad rap, just I think an incorrect rap with non-pilots. I have been talking to a lot of people, and while I have many friends that haven't been flying with me and want to, I'd say the vast majority say, you know what, I think I'll stay on the ground. Let's play with the sim. And I just wish that the word and the perception out there would be better around GA safety. And of course, they read about the Seneca accident in Kentucky, where the family, other than that 7-year-old girl, was lost, and that's a miraculous story that the 7-year-old survived. We had a Baron go down in Chicago a month or two ago with 3 doctors aboard and marginal conditions, and you can tell in that kind of instance that probably pilot error. And that the airplanes are safe, and the pilot is the weak link. But certainly I think that we can get the word out better about the tremendous number of positive experiences and the tremendous amount of safety-conscious pilots that are flying on a regular basis every day, being safe, and doing things right and make it an enjoyable experience. So we've got to work a little bit on that. But, you know, nothing new there. Hey, Tom, I see that you're just on. So, Tom, I look forward to hearing from you tonight. Like you say, a favorite for Av Geeks. Well, let's talk about some more positive news, and that's what's going on in aviation sales. Again, the BizJet market. We're going to be joined by Janine Iannarelli today, and she's with Par Avian. Or she's the president and CEO. And Janine joins us on a quarterly basis to talk to us about what's going on in the market. And so let me pull up this because there's some interesting things that she's going to talk to us about, like I say, some good news. And I think it's important for all of us to kind of keep our finger on the business side, which is not the fun side of it as well. So with that, let me see if we can't get Janine on the phone right now. That sounds like Skype calling. Ouch, that's loud.
Hello?
Janine, it's Mark Eppner with Simple Flight. How are you?
Hey, Mark. How are you this evening?
I'm good. I'm glad you answered on that first ring because that the tone that Skype gives, I think, just broke my eardrums. So it's important to answer on that first ring.
That annoying little ringing in the air.
Yeah, I don't know if it's ringing or just a tone. I think they purposely put it at a frequency that's bothersome. I don't know. We're going to have to complain about that, but we're not going to do that tonight. So how are things and how are you?
I'm doing just fine. Thanks for asking. Nice to join you again in the new year.
Yeah, well, you know, it's something that we look forward to on a quarterly basis. We get lots of positive comments from our viewers. And for those that aren't familiar, for whatever reason, missed last quarter or the previous quarter's report, Par Avian is an international business aircraft marketing firm specializing in the sale of pre-owned business jets with the emphasis on Bombardier, Citations, Falcons, Gulfstreams, Hawkers, and Phenoms. We always seem to be talking the Falcons when we're with you. I think that's your favorite.
It's the nickname I've earned. You know that, Falcon yeah. Lady.
Oh, you know what? Is that something that we'll see in your Twitter handle or something?
No, I'm afraid I haven't used it there. I have a crew chief who handles the Falcon team, or did handle the Falcon team at one of the big service centers, who happened to tell a reporter that, and it stuck, and it became, you know, the nickname that just about everybody in the industry uses for me, those that are in the know, I should say.
You know what? I'm always told about the lack of women's presence in GA and all that, but what I also see is people like yourself, people like Amelia, people like she's not Gulfstream Girl anymore. What does she go by? I can't remember. But she I can't remember. Somebody help me out here. But
I think I know who you're talking about. But yeah.
But what that says to me is the visibility on the women in aviation, at least in those that are in the social media space and all that, is huge compared to their numbers, which I think is great. But it is, like I say, an interesting dynamic. So maybe Falcon Lady, that, like you say, it kind of caught on and it'll propel you. We'll see you on a reality show at some point soon.
Oh, please. I kind of like what I'm doing now.
And what are you doing now?
Oh, selling Falcons, Falcon 2000 LXs. I think we cornered that market in the fourth quarter into the start of this new year. That was our primary focus, landing back-to-back acquisition agreements and having, or I should say, satisfying two new owners.
That is really, really cool. And, you know, I don't know what you sold them for, but let's say that's a $20 million jet or something.
More or less.
More or less, in the ballpark. So to move two of those back to back, that's got to be a good quarter.
Yeah. Good finish to 2014 and a great way to kick off 2015. And, of course, we replaced aircraft for those clients, and we've been tasked with the responsibility to sell their existing aircraft.
So you obviously then had a great year. Is that also representative of the rest of the industry, or are you standing alone and everyone else is having a tough time?
Well, you know, I think it's very spotty. I'm sure if you pull 100 brokers, you might get it split right down the middle. You know, I've always said that the industry is a little bit based on luck, and we happen to have fallen into a very lucky period. Now, you can be lucky, but you also have to be good at what you do, and I am going to pat myself and my team on the back for that, is that we bring a skill set that perhaps not unique, but is certainly very refined to the industry, and add a little luck into that, and it's a great success story for the party that we represent.
Yeah, well, and you know, I'm a big believer, certainly luck plays into a lot of business success, regardless whether it's aviation or otherwise, but you know, luck only maybe gets you the opportunity. You still have to have the skills and the know-it-all and wherewithal to kind of take it across the finish line. So luck only goes so far.
That's right indeed.
So one of the things, and actually I should pause here and congratulate you. You had a political victory as well. I won't say victory, but something related to the politics I see on your website. Something with Texas. Tell us what's going on there.
Yeah, I'm kind of dipping my toe in the water in that arena. It's actually part of my own personal give back to the community agenda, if you will. Several years ago, I realized that given the mobility or access to mobility that I have, the fact that I attend a number of air shows already, I thought, why not be a great proponent of aviation in Texas? It already is a state that is very aviation friendly. And somewhere along the way, come to discover that the state of Texas has a department that actually focuses on business and economic development around the aviation sector. And it's a very broad scope. It deals with aerospace, commercial aviation, military preparedness, and the subset being GA, business aviation. So I had a meeting 2 years ago with the director of this department, and we've corresponded since, and I come to find out that there is an advisory board for which I submitted an application and more or less kind of forgot about it because it really it required that someone was rolled off the board. There are no set terms. Well, the governor decided to do that. They made some adjustments, and in the fourth quarter, Governor Perry appointed me to the Texas Aviation Advisory Board.
Wow.
Which it is. It's just that. It's an advisory board to the office with a very lofty title, if I have it correctly, the Director of Aerospace, Aviation, and Military Preparedness. And as I said, the focus is primarily on business and economic development. They had been rather focused on military and particularly in bringing a spaceport, SpaceX, to Texas. And now that they've achieved goals in those areas, they've broadened the horizon a bit. And I am the first business aviation member to be appointed to this board and the only one at this time.
How cool is that? I mean, is it from a distance, I'm going to say it's cool. Obviously, you love what you do and you can add a lot of value. What is the feeling like going in? Is it like the politics and, you know, a lot of people don't like politics. So what's kind of your aspirations going in? And then also now that you're getting maybe some experience in meetings, is it discussion without decisions, or are you able to really accomplish something?
Well, you know, that's something I yet to discover and find out. But given what I've learned from the director and my observations of the job that he himself has done over the last 2 years, and he's been at it a while, but just in the last 2 years, I'm quite impressed because Texas is being very assertive about drawing new business. I mean, they're developing tax incentives for relocation packages. It's really quite interesting, and I have a lot to learn as of yet. So going forward, I don't fear the political side of it, which obviously, you know, great ideas always have to get bannered around a boardroom. And you don't always get what you want, but what you hope is to get the majority of the good that you want to do, whether it's for an organization, for-profit, non-profit, or in this case, you know, the state itself and for the great, great state of Texas and the people here who will benefit from it.
Yeah, you know, maybe it's just the circles I hang with, but, you know, I look to Adam Smith, formerly of AOPA and now with the Commemorative Air Force, and he's very involved. His sole mission with that is to open this military museum, right? And it's going to be spectacular. And a lot of people came courting, saying, we want that, we want that. But as last I heard, I hope I'm not misrepresenting this, that Texas and maybe even Dallas, I think it was, but again, I'm putting the proviso I might be off there, but Texas was very aggressive and said, we want to have that based here. We want people to come and know about our aviation history. And, you know, they're putting together, I think, what is a very good offer to compete for that business. So I think it speaks to just what you said about their desire to bring new business excitement to the state and therefore bring people to the state. They're going to spend lots of dollars while they're there.
Well, yes, tourism would certainly be one aspect of it. Job creation is the primary focus.
Sure.
State.
Yeah, that's so cool. So you mentioned the success that we had with the 2000 LX. Were there other aircraft types that, you know, also saw good years, whether through PowerAvion or just in general, and, you know, in terms of the momentum in the sales market?
I'd have to say that the small jet market for a select group, and again, this is probably old news for you and the listening audience, but those aircraft that are 15 years or newer, price points, the sweet spot somewhere between $2 and $5 million, I think they still enjoyed a very strong showing in 2014, and that seems to have continued. In fact, I see a little bit of a bump in the values for CJ2s, CJ3s. You know, we have seen a bit of drying up among those models of aircraft, at least domestic aircraft. There's still a number available overseas, but you know, for that size of an aircraft, you really have to be hard-pressed to go overseas to shop for it. Now, that being said, the two that I sold were based overseas. We made it rather easy for the prospective buyer, nicest equipped airplanes within their category, and they were priced right. And given our experience in cross-border transactions, I would have to say that we make it a whole lot easier to do business internationally than perhaps someone who, on occasion, does an overseas transaction. You know, Mark, perhaps you and I have discussed this in the past, but upwards of 90% of our business is cross-border in nature.
Right. Yeah, no, that's important, as you know, it comes down to expertise and people that are going to spend seven figures, eight figures on an airplane certainly don't want to be hassled with the all the things that can trip up a deal or make it run less smooth and ultimately cost them time, which of course is money to these people. So expertise and proficiency is critical. And obviously, like you say, 90% of your business is doing just that. So that's why they come to you.
We'd like more of them to come to us and let us show them the light.
Yeah, there you go. So one of the things in the news that I was reading this, not only this last week, but certainly seen, is one thing at the gas pump. You know, we're at the airport I'm at, people better be sitting down. We're paying for 100 low lead, almost $8 a gallon. Jet A has got to be somewhere in that ballpark as well, for at least for a rack rate or a retail rate. And then just up the road, you can get Jet A at $3.49 and $3.99 for 100 low lead. And the trend is fuel prices are coming down. They're saying they could drop by another 40 to 50% based on the barrel oil. But one of the things, and what I wanted to talk to you about, was that there was a spike in people trying to find more fuel-efficient airplanes. And as the fuel prices come down, some people are saying, you know, that might hurt new business jet sales because people will say, okay, now I can afford to fly my old gas guzzler. What do you think and what are you seeing?
I think if we have a sustained reduction in the price of oil, let me just say this, and this is not just because I'm in the state of Texas, that's not necessarily a good thing overall. I mean, short term, it sounds really exciting. There's all this talk about extra money in everyone's pockets, though sales figures for December, when they came out, did not indicate that the average consumer with that extra money went and spent it on anything.
Got it.
That being said, I think that the lower cost of fuel would actually drive sales across the board, because it's more than just cost of operation when one considers the acquisition of a different aircraft. And there are several factors that are involved. One of them is the existing aircraft I have meeting our current needs? Two, technology changes. I mean, we have pending changes to navigation globally. You've heard the buzzword next gen.
Of course.
Avionics. So depending on what you're operating, Lynn, let's just contain this conversation to the business jet marketplace. You're going to have to update your old aging airplane regardless if you're going to elect to transit certain airspace. And that unto itself may be a motivator for someone to elect to buy a new aircraft. So fuel is certainly a component, but I don't think it is the biggest driving force today.
Interesting. Yeah, actually, again, I know you're talking business jets, and all I can relate to is the 100 low lead and the piston aircraft that I fly. But I was talking to an owner of an airplane, and he was talking about the other prices of repair parts and things that are much greater impact to him than the fuel, even though fuel certainly is significant, and every dollar he can save on a 10, 15, 20 gallon an hour airplane obviously translates. But it was more the parts have just gone up, and he said, you know, what's happening in his opinion was that fewer people are flying. Again, we're talking piston air, or I'm talking about piston aircraft. And so they're trying to make up their margins on the less number of users. Is that something that's at play in the business market as well, or not really?
Well, I think the aging aircraft as a whole, when you see the charges that one has to face or expenses associated with replacement components, ongoing maintenance. We all know that aging aircraft, basically your hourly cost ratchets up, and the biggest component of that becomes your reserves for airframe and engine maintenance. And even the OEMs that have programs that support the engines, they split the charges, a lower rate for aircraft before they reach their TBO, or I should say the engines before they reach their TBO, and then a different higher rate once it's past that TBO. And there are certain aircraft out there whose engines are just so unbelievably expensive that, in fact, has driven down the value of the aircraft. You know, one has to ask themselves, you know, do I want to own an older, cheaper airplane, but yet find myself paying 2 to 3 times the cost to operate because it's an aging aircraft? Right. You know, until we see an overall full-blown recovery in this market, I think you're going to see people hold on to what they have. But again, pressure is being brought to bear from a number of different factors. The cost of cheap fuel is not necessarily going to encourage someone to, one, stay in their older aircraft, or to forego the acquisition of a new one.
Interesting.
You know, Mark, I think we have a bigger picture yet before we can start to dissect the individual components, and that is, while the aviation industry has certainly seen signs of improvement, and our company has benefited from that, we're not yet there where people are returning to the marketplace and exploring all the opportunities that exist in both pre-owned and new market.
Yeah, well, and I spend a lot of time reading news and what's going on in the industry, and you're probably aware that Bombardier has put the Lear 85, kind of pushed the pause button, if you will, as they say, because of the soft market.
Yes, yes. I think their largest order holder was the Flexjet program with 60 orders. And I don't know how many aircraft they sold total, but I thought paused was an interesting adjective that they used to describe their approach to the program. And an article I read on Friday talked about how Bombardier has so much in the pipeline that they just can't support everything, especially if the demand's not there in record numbers for a particular line. You know, again, we need a return to the marketplace of what I call the sweet spot of our buyers, and that are small and mid-cap companies, both public and privately held. And they just have not returned in the numbers that we need to see to sustain all the different models that are in production.
Yeah, I can see that. And actually, our listener, Tom, just tweeted in that he says biz jets get bought and sold on value perception, which, of course, I think is no different than how everything is. And each owner defines that differently. It's all relative. And I believe, and I look to you for confirmation, is that especially when people are spending the kind of money, they're obviously, I won't say how the other half lives, how the other point X percent live, that really doesn't change, does it? I mean, we have a guy here, I won't mention any names, but he has a Jetstar, which is not an economical plane, obviously, with four engines burning some 500 gallons an hour, I think it is. And, you know, that has value to him, although he also owns a Challenger, so it depends on his mission. So what about it in terms of the buyer of these very expensive jets? Is it no different than how I say when I go to buy a piece of furniture? And it's a value proposition, or do they not look at value proposition when they're spending their millions? Oh,
they absolutely look at value proposition. Nobody wants to leave any money on the table. So they are looking for the aircraft that suits their mission requirements best. And then once we arrive at a make and model, for example, then we go into the marketplace and try to secure the best deal possible. I think, for the most part, you and I are talking about private individuals. We're not talking about corporations.
Right.
You know, and that harks back to the comment you made about, does the price of fuel or really anything else impact these users of these aircraft? And certainly we've seen it on the corporation side, particularly publicly traded companies who just have felt the pressure left and right, that some have exited aircraft ownership altogether. Others have put plans for revitalization on hold or replacement on hold. And yet, private individuals, entrepreneurs, privately held companies, they'll move forward on a project. If they're in a financial position to do so, there's nothing that's going to hold them back. But that is a relatively small percentage of the entire aircraft buying public.
Of course. Yeah, actually, we used to talk about when we sold whatever, again, small business, had nothing to do with aviation. For a business owner, it was always put in our mind, what is the value proposition for that small business? Because that person might be saving for a very expensive car, airplane, whatever. And so they've got to divert their dollars from their business to say, hey, am I going to get my new Mercedes, or am I going to get this thing, this technology this person's selling me? So it's always opportunity cost and what else they could do with their dollars.
Exactly that.
It doesn't change, does it? Only no. The numbers change.
Only the numbers change. Oh, boy, do they.
Yeah. So as you look at, you know, the different type of markets within it, and I mentioned to you off air how the AirShares Elite, which is basically a Cirrus-based fractional program, closed its doors in the last, I think it's 30 to 45 days, which they're the longstanding powerhouse, if there is such a thing, in that industry. And wondered if there's any relevancy to now how people get into these airplanes to conduct their business. And as fractional programs, NetJets, Citation Shares, FlexJets, whatever it is, are they seeing an uptick, or is now ownership, sole ownership or partnerships, somehow taking the momentum away from those fractionals?
Well, I don't see whole ownership taking momentum away from the fractionals. Quite frankly, I think the fractionals are a great prospecting ground for anyone who's selling a business jet. I mean, sooner or later, someone who has had an equity share, a piece of an airplane, if you will, may come to realize that they are going to fly a bit more. And in order to meet their flying needs, buying a larger fractional share may not be the answer, because at some point, the cost just outweighs the utilization or the benefits of utilizing aviation in that way. And that is when those people start looking at whole ownership, particularly if you talk about a pre-owned aircraft where you can buy a whole lot of airplane for $2 to $3 million. And that, in some cases, is less than the cost of buying into a quarter share on certain airplanes. And I would think, now we talked earlier about how fuel might impact the aviation industry, and I would say that with the lower cost of fuel, the fractionals may see, first of all, increased revenue because, you know, they're pocketing whatever their hourly costs are and their fuel costs are now less. To increased interest, because technically the cost of operation should be less when fuel surcharges are not passed along. Same for charter. One would think that, you know, you'd start to see a little bit of boom in the utilization of aircraft in both those sectors.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. So one of the questions, and again, we just got a tweet in asking, do you see operation cost shock or acquisition cost shock more when buying and selling? You know, which, as you look at the cost of getting into it or the cost of actually owning it, where is the most impact in terms of people drop their jaw?
Well, for the experienced aircraft owner, they already know what they're getting into. For the first time buyer, we try to minimize the shock of the acquisition by detailing, and I mean in great detail, all the costs that they can expect, at least through the acquisition process. And then we offer some guidance, particularly if they have no flight department or are in the process of establishing one, of what they can expect for out-of-pocket expenses for at least the coming year based on X amount of hours utilization and the make and model of airplane, of course. So it's the shock is for the first time buyer. I don't see where someone who has a history in the marketplace does not understand what it's going to cost to continue to operate. Now, obviously, if they're making a move from a much smaller aircraft to a much larger aircraft, it may give them pause for thought when they sit back and look at the price for engine hot sections or engine overhauls. When you go from a Williams FJ44 to a Rolls-Royce, or I should say Rolls-Royce BMW engine, oh yeah, it's the cost of some airplanes to pull the hot sections on those aircraft.
You know, this brings up something I remember. I was, I don't know how many years ago, but there was an old Lear. I want to say it may have been a 35, but I'm not sure. But it was an old Lear, and I was told, I mean, these people had sold it. It sounded like a darn cheap price, you know, six figures, but it wasn't significant. And I was talking to the owner, and he basically said, sending it to another country, and the people were going to basically throw away the plane. They were just doing it to get the engines. And because they acquired the engines so inexpensively at this beat up old Lear, and so that's all he wanted.
Well, I hope the price of that airplane was down under $250,000, because those 731-2 engines could probably have been procured in the resale marketplace pretty darn cheap also.
Yeah, I think it was. I want to say like $150,000 or something.
That would make sense. And, you know, obviously then the value is dependent upon cycles and times on those two engines and where it stood in relationship to its next hot section or overhaul. But yeah, then it's a throwaway airplane. Keep the engines.
That just amazes me. You know, that's why people like you are in it, because I don't understand how that works. If the engines are worth more, you think they'd get more. But somehow, I guess they just wanted to turn that thing into cash and get rid of it so they could get their new Lear 45 or whatever they bought from that. I think it was they replaced a 35 with a 45.
You know, it's interesting. If it's a corporation that owns the airplane, you know, they've obviously taken advantage of depreciation. So whatever they sell the aircraft for is capital gains. And then you have to look at the cost of holding an airplane you're not using. I often go in and counsel some of our clients that while perhaps an offer we've received on an aircraft is not necessarily where we would like to be, they have to look at it as if it might be the only offer we'll see for the next 2 to 3 months, during which time how much money will be spent in maintaining the aircraft. The difference might be exactly what it would cost for 90 days more of holding as opposed to accepting the slightly lower offer today.
Yeah. I'm sitting here thinking, how cool would it be to get into this? But, you know, I just don't know how people do it. Again, it's probably... like you say, the business just makes sense for it or it doesn't, and it's an easy decision. But it seems to me with the individual owner, which is such a small percentage, it's a whole different set of rules.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Well, if you're an individual owner, you must really want an airplane, to have an airplane. I mean, there's certainly always a need for one. Hey, I need an aircraft. I just can't afford one. But the individual owners, it's a personal decision. It's driven by many factors, whether it's their own business or their own personal needs. And, you know, God love them. We need those buyers. Those are the buyers that kept everyone in my industry alive through the economic downturn.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's have some fun with this. Tom just tweeted another question. And I'm sure you're very well aware of these talks of building an SST, supersonic transport, for in the biz jet market, have been in the news over the last several months. What do you think is the market for that? Is not only in the near term or long term, is there going to be enough of a market to drive the production of an SST in the biz jet area?
Well, let me start off by saying, if anyone from Aireon is listening, we'd love you to come build that airplane in Texas.
Yeah, there you go. Now there comes the politics side.
There is a market for that aircraft. I think they'll be standing in line to buy the airplane when a product is finally announced. I really do. I mean, I've heard numbers tossed at $100 million for an SST, but think about it. Think about cutting the travel time. Time is money. And, you know, today when we talk about market caps at billions of dollars, I think that you're going to find the world's global leaders, corporations, individuals, standing in line to buy one.
Yeah, but, you know, again, it's cut the time. Time is money and all that. But just as we talked before, there's a value prop, right? At some point, it doesn't make sense, even though you're saving hours. And I don't know, $100 million, maybe the Donald Trumps of the world. But, of course, he has his, what, 777 or 757, I think.
757.
Yeah. I don't know. It doesn't seem to me like there'd be enough people to support all of the things that go into it. But maybe in the future, it will be a requirement for business.
Well, look at how many G650s they sold at, what, 65 million?
Yeah, Justin Bieber, right? Didn't he get into one?
I know he has Gulfstream, or he had a Gulfstream, but I didn't know it was a G650.
Yeah, I think it is, and I wasn't sure if that was sole ownership or he got into some exclusive fractional or partnership type of a situation.
Well, there are certain charter operators who I don't think want to see him again.
Yeah, right. Doesn't he have a tendency to trash the airplanes?
Yeah. I guess his last flight that was made very public didn't go very well.
Yeah, well, I don't want to spend any time talking about him. He's not one of my favorites. It's too much money, too soon, too young of an immature person, but I digress.
Yes. Let's go back to the people who truly see the value and the benefit of having a business aircraft and who understand how fortunate they are as well.
I don't know if we talked to you about the executive helicopter market. Is that something that Paravion is involved with at all, or do you have an opinion on where
we dabble in it? Last year we handled the sale, the year before I should say, an S-76B, and I used to make quite a market in the Dauphine. It's been a while, but you know, we dabble in it.
And is there an uptick in that market or in that demand just based on ability to get from, you know, the suburbs, let's say, in a major market to a downtown building, land on the roof and have access to corporate America that way?
Well, you know, my experience with the helicopter marketplace is to some degree limited, but what I have witnessed over the course of my career is that that market seems to lag behind the aviation fixed-wing marketplace by about 6 to 9 months. So when jets started sliding, helicopters were still doing quite well and vice versa. As far as what's selling, you know, honestly, I don't think I can answer that or articulate very well about it, Mark, but I notice an increase of helicopter sales here in Houston. I mean, perhaps that's no surprise given the boom in the oil and gas industry. And I don't mean offshore helicopters. I mean VIP configuration. And I watch more or less what's trading, 407s, the S-76D, Agustas. And I'd say that they're experiencing not much different than what we were last summer, early last year.
Interesting.
You know, start of an increase in demand. But that's about as far as I could go with it. I guess I can't tell you much more until I start looking into it myself.
Sure, I understand. And I mentioned, gosh, a few shows ago, we have a few young people here, I think all except one under the age of 30, that have started a little helicopter business at Chicago Executive that was just doing tours and R-44. And then they bought the second one, and then they bought a third one, a turbine. I don't even know the model number, but it's a big one that I would call more executive. And they're putting together contracts to deliver executives that fly into the local feeder airports, if you will, the Pewaukees, DuPages, and all in the Chicagoland area, and then flying those people downtown.
So, where's the heliport in Chicago?
There's one, I think they're involved with building it, but there was a lot of, back to the political thing, and oh my goodness, in Chicago politics, you know, in terms of the restrictions on building your own. So there is a heliport, I think, on the fringe, and I don't know exactly where it is, but they've established, I believe, a relationship with that heliport that's going to get people much closer to downtown. I'll have to get you more information offline because I just don't know it off my head.
Yeah, just curious.
Yeah, I'm curious. I'll have to look that up. Well, great. Hey, Janine, you know, it's always a pleasure each quarter to catch up. I always feel optimistic about where aviation's going after I talk to you. I come away feeling the same in this conversation because it sounds like there's some momentum going in 2015, and I personally think the fuel cost coming down from an operational, maybe not on the acquisition stuff point, will help fuel, excuse the expression, a pun, further sales in the biz market, and hopefully that translates down to GA as well, or into Piston GA.
I agree. It's a good thing for the time being, and I think it will provide a motivational factor, if you will, for people who just want to get back out there and fly.
Like me.
Yeah, there you go. You can fly more now.
Yeah, I flew yesterday and today, so let's keep it going.
All right, good deal.
All right, Janine, thanks again. Wish you a great week and looking forward to next time we chat.
All right, Mark, thanks for the invitation. Y'all have a good evening.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, there you go. Things are looking up. I feel I'm proud of her. It's not that she needs me to be proud of her, but wow. Two sales in the fourth quarter for the Falcon 2000 LX. I'm in sales. That would be a heck of a quarter. That makes a heck of a year. So our congratulations to her, and congratulations to her for being invited on the advisory board by the governor. That's cool. I think I'm going to have to look into doing something like that. I can already hear my wife, who's listening to this, say, wait a minute, you run a flying club, you're working your butt off at your normal day job, you do the radio show, all these things, and now you want to be on a governmental advisory board? The answer is yes, I do. All right, so let's move on. I said that I wanted to talk about some peeves that I have, and not pet peeves, but things that are bothering me, and one of the first thing that is... we just talked about with Janine and slightly before, fuel prices coming down. And that's all great news. We've seen actually in auto gas, many states have gone below $2 a gallon. And, you know, we're in Chicago and Illinois, which seems to have the highest stuff. You know, we're at $2.06 at my local station, which is cool. And I know Missouri, Iowa, other surrounding states are below $2. One of my frustrations with auto fuel was that as soon as there's a hint of bad news, and I might be wrong on this, but this is my opinion based on what I hear, there's a scare, and maybe oil's going to be tougher to come by. Immediately, our gas rates just shoots through the sky, right? We were $2, $3, $4 a gallon. And then when there's good news, it's like, let's wait to react. Am I wrong? Tell me if I'm wrong. But it just seems like they go up so quick on the rumor of bad news and come down so slow on the reality of good news. How does that work? And when I hear people on the radio talk about it, they explain it. No, it's all fine. I don't believe it. It's kind of like sublimation. I don't believe that there is such a thing as sublimation, at least not in the sense of taking ice off of an airplane wing once you just get out of the cloud and you're in the sun. It takes a very long time. Same thing with fuel prices coming down. I'm glad they're coming down now, but why does it take so long? Next part of that question is, I'm told that they make aviation's fuel supply in like 2 days. It's less than 1% of all fuel that's made for cars, trucks, all that. Aviation fuel is done. So if aviation fuel is made and refined and all of that in 2 days, then why is any of the ups and downs of the market reflected at all? It should be at that price that it was refined at. So is it just profit taking? are people saying we have other expenses, so we're going to do it again? We used to pay, and now I'm going back a little bit, but maybe in the last 10 years, weren't we at about $2, $2.50 a gallon for avgas? We saw it go up at this airport I'm at now, like I say, to $8. You see it at the major Bravo airports and O'Hare and all that of $9 a gallon. And, okay, now I'm seeing $3.99 at the cheapest at Burlington, Wisconsin, Bravo uniform, if you happen to be in the Midwest. And Jet A is $3.49 there. Now, that includes the subsidy from the community because they want to drive people to fly there. And it's working. We fly out of this airport and fly that 15, 20 minutes up the road to get gas at $3 less an hour, or excuse me, $3 less a gallon, which at, let's say, 15 gallons an hour is obviously $45 an hour savings. So why aren't we seeing the fluctuations, and why does one airport drop it by a few dollars and another one say, no, their costs remain the same? And you know, maybe they'll come down a dime or something. Someone will tell me it's taxes. I don't know. I feel like, you know, that there's something amiss here, and I don't know why people don't do something about it. What do you guys think? Why, you know, oil volatility, Tom's talk. Tom, I feel like you're my co-host tonight. Thanks for coming in. Oil volatility mirrors any commodity's volatility. Sure, but if the manufacturer has already... the manufacturing process and refinement process has already taken place, it's just out in the market. Why is there fluctuations if they're not making more? There's no more manufacturing, no more refining. It's done for the year. Someone educate me, because I just don't get it, as I said. And so it bothers me. Again, I have an owner here that owns a 180-horse airplane, four-seater, single-engine piston, and he talks about his mags that used to cost $500 now are $1,500, and so he has to go to rebuilt mags to keep it at $500. Everything's going up. He says it's because less people, less purchasers, got to spread the margin over a smaller group, i.e. that drives prices up. All right, I get it. I don't like it, but I get it. But what about fuel? Someone needs to help me with that one. Number two, and I even wrote these down. So number two, the FAA, and it's, well, they have a process. I have to respect that they have a process. But I think it was last week, maybe the week before, Al and I were talking about how the FAA said instead of 10 hours of sim time being credited to your instrument rating, for instance, they're going to go to 20 hours. And instead of, and many of you probably don't know this, but when you're using a sim, you need to wear your foggles or your any view-limiting device. What? Yes. As I was told by the FAA, the room, peripheral vision of a room that the sim is in adds stability to the picture and therefore takes away from the real value of instrument training in a simulator. I don't buy it, but you know, smarter people than me are telling me that. So, okay, we're making progress. Now, the FAA process, they grabbed all of the feedback from people that wrote in, and evidently there's a rule there that says if you get one negative contrary position from someone that contributes, you can't pass it. So I understand there were two people that didn't like the rule. One was the CFI. It said, no, it's not like the real thing. We shouldn't be doing this in a sim. So now the FAA has taken that away from us. It's back to 10 hours. It's back to you need to wear the foggles or view-limiting device of your choice, the hood. That makes no sense to me. Because let's for the moment accept that it isn't as good as in the airplane. I guess I tend to buy that. But this is only training. When you do your test, when you go out for an instrument rating check ride, you have to perform to PTS standards. It doesn't matter if you trained on Microsoft Flight Sim and and never set foot in an airplane, in my opinion. Can you perform in the airplane to a valid, thorough FAA check ride for your instrument rating? If you do, I don't care how you got there. You proved it in the airplane. So why now are you saying how you get there is just as important as whether you test well, whether you demonstrate your skills well? It's just, to me, is driving up the cost of aviation, of training, putting people in a more expensive airplane than a less expensive sim. And it just seems to me that you shouldn't have to meet certain number of hours in an airplane, again, if you can demonstrate to PTS standards in an airplane with an FAA designated pilot examiner or examiner, you're good. So again, what do you think? Number three, FAA, in its infinite wisdom, has decided they don't have the personnel, which I'm good with this part of it. They don't have the personnel to enforce and watch over the drones that are out there. Drones, quadcopters, whatever you want to call them. And so they've passed that off to local law enforcement. We've already seen so many times when local law enforcement gets involved with aviation compliance, they mess it up. It's inconsistent. You go from one law enforcement body in one city to the next. Interpretation of rules is different, all that. So now your local police force, God love them, I respect them for what they do, but now they're going to have to determine, is that drone too high? Did it just go into controlled airspace? Are they following the rules? And I just don't think they're equipped to do it. I'm not saying I have a better answer because, again, the FAA, they don't have the money to put the people on board to enforce this. We have to learn how to handle this. The drones, they are a coming. They are a here. And I don't want to get hit by one, or I don't want to hit one while I'm flying. So I think there does have to be some rules and regulations, and someone needs to enforce that those are done. You know, it's just kind of like the lasers in a sense that people that don't understand about interactions of flying objects, airplanes, drones, whatever, are out there playing with this stuff, and they shouldn't. Just like we need to get training to fly in the skies, people that are flying these and remote control airplanes or radio controlled airplanes, they need to do that. They need to understand and be taught. It has to be part of the process. And while difficult, I just think there's a safety issue that's just going to make the headlines here if we just let it go and then all of a sudden send it off to local law enforcement who knows nothing about that which happens above the ground to enforce and to ensure compliance. So those three things are really bugging me. I'm interested to know what you think. Tom, you've been on a lot. Give me a little tweet here. Tell me what you think about those three things and what's where am I right, where am I wrong? All right, let's see. What else do we have here? I feel like, you know, when I grew up, and yes, I'm older than some of you, many of you, there was the Ray Rayner show. And if it was that part of Bozo Circus? I don't remember. But here, I'm in the Chicagoland area, and there was a guy that wore... It actually kind of looked like a flight suit. It wasn't supposed to be a flight suit. And he had essentially post-it notes all over his body with the things that he wanted to cover. You know, oh, let's go to this cartoon. Let's go to this thing. And he just kept pulling these post-it notes off his suit. That's how I am here. I got all these little notes of things that I want to talk about. And it started with those three pet peeves. Tom isn't tweeting me. He's ignoring me. But, there we go. You did. Thanks, buddy. Complicated issues, good arguments on both sides. The main problem, no leadership on each issue. I couldn't agree more. Because someone needs to put their foot down and say, this is what we're going to do. And it has to be a well-thought-out thing. But someone, it's this, as I mentioned to Janine, one of the things that frustrates me the most in business is discussion without decision. endless discussion, people going back and forth, things are delayed. No one makes a decision. No one moves forward. And it's, you know, the difference between management and leadership, a manager manages status quo. It's not meant to be changed. And that's what I feel like we have here is we're managing the issues, so it's all about status quo. Where leadership, by my definition, is all about someone taking a team, a person, whatever, to a new place. It's about change. It's about making things better. And so we need to move from management to leadership. And that's what Tom here says, that there's no leadership on each of the issues that I just brought up. So, Tom, you get my vote. You are the leader that we need in there. How about that? Let's see. Now, of course, that I said that, I just dropped my little note that I was planning what's next. Oh, okay. I brought this up at the beginning. By the way, as you can tell, when Al isn't here, when we don't have the one-hour guest, I'm kind of like doing the fireside chat. Let's talk about things that are on my mind. Let's get involved. Let's have the conversation. And so I appreciate – I actually enjoy these, and I think the listeners are so much a part of this that you guys really enjoy the topics of the day. So I'm glad you're out there because it gives me a reason to put this microphone in front of my mouth and talk about what's going on and get it off my chest and hopefully help drive some change as well. One of the things that I brought up at the beginning was that, you know, yesterday I flew and the winds were 220. And this isn't a pet peeve now or a peeve. This is, I'm interested to get feedback. So maybe this is just for Tom. Since everyone seems to be out of town or away from their computer, Tom and I have a one-on-one show here going. But winds 220, 17 gust 29. I'm at an airport with a beautiful runway 16 and a very narrow, crooked, bumpy displaced threshold with trees 24. So what do you do? Four-seat, single-engine, piston airplane, you know, your standard 172 Archer, Dakota, maybe a Cirrus, Mooney, whatever. I hear so many people go, and I'm included in at this airport because 24 is not the easiest of runways. I mean, it's fine, especially for the experienced pilot. But a lot of people just, you know what, I'll take the 60-degree crosswind, and they take runway 16. Not many take 24. Another thing with this, the trees that you go over, it's a very bumpy final approach when you're coming into 24. And again, I'd say probably close to half of the runway 24 is displaced. So you can use it for takeoff, but not for touching down. And again, if it's all about glide path in there. So what do you do? I'm interested to understand, what do you do in terms of when do you say, I'm not going because I don't fly when it's gusting 29, even if it is within 20 degrees of the runway heading? Or do you say, I'm going to fly, but why would I take any other runway but one that was more closely aligned with the wind? I admit I have done the 16 instead of 24. Matter of fact, I did it yesterday. However, today when I flew in, wind was 300. I think it was 13 gusting 20. I was in a Piper Dakota, and they just said cleared to land runway 34. Unless you want 30. So again, even the control tower defaults to the main 1634. And because it was 30, because 30 actually runs pretty much straight to my hangar that I was going to, I asked for, and I was coming from the west, so I just could enter a nice downwind. I said, I'll take 30. But many, many people default to 34 and not take 30. So how about you? When would you decide to say, I'm either not flying because it's too strong, or I'm going to use the runway that's more closely aligned with it? What about your own airport? Do you have any multi-runway airports that you're at, and then you use maybe something other than wind to make a decision on where you're going to land, which direction? I'd be interested to hear. And you can just tweet us at hashtag SimpleFlight. or you can send us an email, although I'm not getting the Simple Flight emails. That's Al's thing. I got to figure out how he gets that on his little Hootsuite. I'm finding some things. It's interesting when you just start clicking, right? Don't be afraid to click. You start to feel like you really have some proficiency here, almost like you're in the cockpit. Boy, this is it. This is neat. All right, what's next? So I wanted to bring up our friends at Bold Method. Bold Method has a quiz, and so I'm going to give you a quiz. Let me just... Silence is bad radio. I know. Let me just trying to get to these. I set up a bunch of things that I wanted to talk about, and I got to pull up each page separately. I need a better system, Al Waterloo. Where are you when I need you? Here we go. Okay, so that's fuel. Oh, here's one thing before I go to Bold Method. Uber Chopper. You all know with the Uber system, right? The especially in major cities. You pull out your little app on your smartphone. You say, I need a ride. I don't want to call a cab. And then the picture shows up. It says, hey, the car is 4 minutes away. And now they've been in the news for some, I think the last two issues that have come up is these drivers, two different drivers had a little sexual assault problem, which is just going to play havoc with the Uber program. Matter of fact, the city of Chicago, the cabs, which... fought Uber because the cabs, of course, pay fees to the city of Chicago to get their medallion to be able to drive people around, and Uber is just doing it. But now Uber is offering helicopter rides. So Uber has branched out to provide helicopter flights at certain times through what the company calls Uber Chopper. The flights are posted on Uber's blog at blog.uber.com. Most recently, Uber offered a free promo Christmas flight for four over the Silicon Valley. The flights are conducted through local helicopter operators. Most of the time, the flights are cost-based and include transportation from the local area to the location of the Uber Chopper and the Uber Black vehicle, the premium option, which includes a licensed chauffeur driving a black sedan or SUV. If there is a local Uber Chopper opportunity, you will be able to toggle to the Uber Chopper option on the bottom bar of the home screen. If there are no flights available, then the Uber Chopper icon will not be displayed. The flights are rare and often include luxury add-ons. Uber has offered helicopter flights since mid-2013 in many cities around the globe, including Rio de Janeiro, Lisbon, Portugal, Melbourne, Australia, and Cape Town, South Africa. Over the Labor Day weekend, Uber offered a 45-minute helicopter tour over LA, which included a safari tour of the Malibu Wines property. The cost for the Malibu flight was $500 per person. All right, so that's kind of cool, right? And it's a little promotional thing. It's kind of like a Groupon and all. But where does this stop? Does Uber Helicopter Chopper or whatever become a companion to regular Uber and people start regularly taking helicopters? I mean, it's obviously a different clientele, but potentially in some cities around the world, it's could be an option in a New York, in a Chicago, in an LA, in a Silicon Valley, potentially in a Houston or Dallas, some of the major markets out there. And doesn't this go against what the ruling came down recently on the ride sharing, right? That you can't offer yourselves up. Now, maybe Uber is getting, part 135 or whatever they need to get to do this commercially, or maybe all they need is a commercial license. I don't know. I would think there'd be some kind of requirement like a 135 before they could do it. But otherwise, I think they're treading on the same ground when they stop these ride-sharing programs, and which are being sued by, which are those people are suing the government for that decision. So it'll be interesting to see if those will be brought back. Hey, Tom, I see that you tweeted, and again, having personal runway length limits and crosswind limits leads to better decisions. professional world calls this SOP, Standard Operating Procedure. Of course it does. And I was just interested in yours, for instance. You know, I remember the day I would never fly at with gusts of 29 knots, even if it's within 20 degrees. I remember one day, by the way, Elson, I just realized how I just went from Uber Chopper back to the previous topic. So I'm a little ADD today, so I hope you're with me. So I remember one flight I was coming in. We're flying in from the west to Chicago, and we were pretty far out. And I started listening to ATC, and the winds were 14 gusting, I want to say 14 gusting 45. Not your average crosswind gust. And the winds were, I'm going to say, 250. And again, remember, my airport has a real crappy 24, but a wonderful 16. They also have a 30, right? So that would have been a better choice there. And just up the road is Waukegan, Uniform Gulf November, and they have a runway 25. And it's a beautiful runway. So I looked to my wife, my passenger on that day, and I said, if it stays 14 gusts 45, you know, we're going to stop early. We're going to divert. And all of the business jets were diverting to O'Hare instead of landing at Papawisky Key. And we're only 8 miles from O'Hare, 8 nautical miles. But it was interesting because they have company, Tom, what you call the SOPs. And with that crosswind, with that speed, they can't land on 16. 24 is too small, short for the biz jets here. So they were all diverting. And I said I would too. But when I got here, the wind was, I want to say, 14 gusts 29. But it was still a pretty hefty crosswind, probably around 2-2, which is exactly what it was yesterday. And I took runway 16 on that one. And, you know, with proper crosswind technique, it worked out just fine. So it's funny, you know, Tom, to your point before, my personal minimums have changed because as we get more experience, more confident, we are willing to step outside our comfort zone and stretch the envelope a little bit. The scary thing is if you ever take it one step too far, which is why you do it in small increments. You don't go from 5 knots to 29 knots from one flight to the next. But again, I'm interested to know what you're doing. So even if you're listening to this as a podcast throughout the week, go to the simpleflight.net website and let us know what you think. You know, what are your personal minimums, that we'll call it, or standard operating procedures for runway length, direction and all that when it comes to gusty winds. All right, next thing. Okay, the drones, we talked about that. I mentioned in talking to Janine the Bombardier people pausing the Lear 85. I thought that was – I'm disappointed. You know, the Lear 85 is something that looks really cool. It's a mostly composite business jet. They say the market is too soft both for that product and for light to mid-sized jets. The suspension will result in the layoff of a total of 1,000 workers at production facilities in Wichita and Querétaro, Mexico. About 620 of the layoffs will be in Wichita. After a series of delays on the Lear 85, the company went quiet about the project over the last few months, and Thursday's announcement wasn't much of a surprise to some analysts. It had been rumored for months that three major development projects, the 85, the C-Series airliner, and Global 7000/8000, were squeezing the coffers at the company, and the company confirmed that the 85 was sacrificed for the other two programs. This is a quote from CEO Pierre Beaudoin. We will focus our resources on our two other clean sheet aircraft programs under development, C-Series and Global 7000/8000, for which we see tremendous market potential. Both of those programs are progressing well. C-Series has also strained Bombardier's resources. A series of setbacks, including an engine explosion that halted flight testing for months, had put the program 2 years behind schedule. The company insists first deliveries will start by the end of this year, but there is skepticism about that prediction. Just like Wrigley Field isn't going to have the bleachers ready for the start of the season, right? My brother calls it oops factor, ordinary oversights postpone systems, right? People, it's scope creep, and all the little things are too aggressive when they put out the timeline. They promise it, and of course it never happens. The bright spot is the 7,000 or 8,000 project. There's been little drama about the aircraft, which will compete directly with Gulfstream's G650 long-range big cabin jet. The 7,000 expected to go into service on time, so take that, Mark Eppner, in 2016, followed a year later by the 8,000, and there are orders for more than 60 aircraft worth more than $3 billion. That's pretty cool. Those are the kind of things that I look forward to. Let's see, what else do we have here? Okay, that was that, and that's that. So I got through most of the stuff that I wanted to talk about. The only other thing is, I was said I'm going to have a little quiz for you. We're going to go to the Bold Method site, and that is right here. Can you answer these six questions? Number one, this is pretty easy. I'll be really disappointed if anyone gets this wrong. You're taking off, and you need to clear an obstacle using your best angle of climb. What speed are you flying? VS, VS plus 10 knots, VNO, VX, VA plus 10 knots, VY. All right. Do, 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 do. Okay. Best angle of climb is VX. We all know that. You know how I remember that, by the way? The X has more angles than the Y. So best angle. That has been my way of thinking about that since the early 70s. When you retract your flaps, you immediately decrease lift, drag, camber, or all of the above. Of course, all of the above. What causes ground effect? Thicker air near the runway, reduced parasite drag, reduced induced drag, or increased available thrust near the runway? The answer, reduced induced drag. What climb rate will a single engine aircraft produce at its absolute ceiling, at max weight, clean configuration, max continuous power? 0 foot per minute, 25 foot per minute, 50 foot per minute, 75 foot per minute, 150 foot per minute, or 150 foot per minute? Actually, Elson, I'm blanking out on this. I'm going to answer this and see what it comes up. Let me just finish here. All right, I just scored all of them real quick. I scored 83%. So the answer is 100. Or no, is 0 foot per minute. You know what? I answered that the last time, and I thought it was wrong. It was that, okay? During a stall, your wing continues to produce lift. True or false? It's true. In a training aircraft, this is the last question, the center of lift is normally forward, aft, or at the same position of the center of gravity. It's aft. Right? So how'd you do? I got 83%. And that the one I got wrong, I had right before, which is 0 foot per minute. I thought I got it wrong, so I thought, oh, what is it? So, all of that. Anyway, I think what we're going to do tonight is just like we did last time. We're not going to unnecessarily continue to 10 o'clock because you guys will get bored with me, and then you won't tune in next week, and I want you to tune in. Hopefully Al will be back in town. I love doing this. I love your interaction. Tom, I appreciate your interaction tonight. You know, this aviation thing is wonderful. And what I love about it is the family, the community aspect of it. You know, people that listen in, we have lots of listeners. We have lots of downloads. It's growing each week. We've been doing this for 2.5 years. And just like when I flew out to Bloomington today, you know, it's Sunday, all of a sudden one of the guys from the flying club says, hey, let's grab a couple planes, go the 80-some miles south, go to Bloomington, Illinois, Bravo Mike, India. They got an airport on airport restaurant right there off the runway. And so we grabbed two. We got three guys in a Cirrus SR-22 and two in a Dakota. We went down there, had a great meal, CJ's. Came back, it was about 3:30. And then we just sat in this little, our pilot cave, I guess you could call it. We call it Ledge at the Leading Edge Flying Club. It's just a room with some couches and a TV. And we just talked about flying. And one of the people that went is a student pilot going for his private. And he just started asking questions. And what a terrific learning environment that was. You know, he talked about icing here in the Midwest. That's something we worried about. We worry about. And it just led to a conversation about Fiki and when can you fly and when you can you not. He talked about some of his embarrassing moments, which we all just shook our head yes to. Yep, we have those same embarrassing moments, whether you're a student pilot or a licensed pilot. And we see it in the news for the people that have the real dangerous ones. But we all do it. Forget to set the altimeter. Forget to retract the flaps or whatever. I've seen people take off in their Bonanza and leave the wheels down. Saw that in the Navajo, actually. And so it's by sharing, it's by talking, it's by taking advantage of this community that we all get better. And it, you know, there's so much enjoyment in the conversation. It was a wonderful afternoon just sitting around having just talk about airplanes and how to get better. So that's what I see that we do on this show. We're going out and seeing if we can find amazing people doing amazing things in aviation. But it's the things that we learn by talking to them that really makes this special to me. That's the other thing I want you guys to know. What is special about this show to you? We're also, Al and I are deep with a consultant about possible changes to the format of this show. And we're considering a lot of things. And we're building a survey, but in advance of the survey going out, I'd love to hear from you. Matter of fact, I'm going to give you my personal email address. Certainly the Twitter at Mepner, M-E-P-N-E-R, Mike Echo Papa, November Echo Romeo. Or send it to my email address, which is M-E, my initials, Mark Eppner, 02, M-E-02 at AOL.com. And yes, I have been doing this so long that I could pick any email address when AOL started, and so I picked me too. But ME02 at AOL.com, and your feedback, your advice, your likes and dislikes are all very, very important to us, and we look forward to getting them. So with that, I think we're going to call it a show. We hope Al is back next week. He adds a lot to the show, but again, he's out there training people right now. So on behalf of Al and the entire staff here at Simple Flight Radio, I wish you blue skies and strong tailwinds. Good night, everybody. Talk to you next week.
You're listening to Simple Flight Aviation Radio with Al Waterloo and Mark Eppner on www.simpleflight.net.
Simple Flight Radio, ready for takeoff.
What do you think about flying? Is it a sport? A business? Is it easy or difficult? Is it boring or exciting? Alan Waterloo and Mark Eppner think it may be any of those things, but they like to make it simple. This is Simple Flight Radio, where Mark and Al talk about the many aspects of aviation and the amazing people doing amazing things to make this world a better place.